I hope you'll bear with me in that, because it cannot be otherwise. But on the other evenings, I will try to make the lectures more complete in themselves. Now, I tried this morning, with those of you who were here, to give a quick sketch of the Bible view of sex as a very healthy, positive view, very closely linked with religion, and altogether a very worthy concept of sex, which we need to recover in our modern world. But I'm going to talk to you this evening about what happened after that in the development of Christian tradition, and it is a rather sad story, but it's one that we have simply got to face. It's a story that has not very often been told because it is rather disturbing, but we Christians are simply not going to be able to understand the sexual revolution of our time, which is the subject of my lecture for tomorrow morning, except against the background of the historical treatment of sex in our Christian tradition. I remember years ago when I was reading church history how impressed I was with the gallant struggle of the early church against the pollution of its doctrines by all kinds of heresies. And one of the major issues that involved the early church in tremendous conflict was the struggle between the naturalism of the Bible and the dualism of the philosophy that was prevalent in the world at that time. By the naturalism of the Bible, I mean the belief that the world and everything in it was good as made by God. And by the dualism that confronted that naturalism, I mean the belief that the world, the material world, and the human body were evil, and that only the spiritual was good. Let me elaborate that a little bit. William Temple, the great Archbishop of Canterbury, whom I had the privilege to know very well personally and greatly admired, once said that Christianity was the most materialistic of all the great world religions. That seems a strange thing to say, doesn't it? But he really meant it, and it is a very important truth. He meant that Christianity, as distinct from most of the other great religions of the world, though not including Judaism, of course, is based on a conception that the world is good because it was created by God, the great doctrine of creation, in which God made everything in the world and looked on it and saw that it was good. Moreover, Christianity is based, secondly, on the great doctrine of the incarnation, that God took upon himself mortal flesh and identified himself with it, that he came down to earth in his Son and lived in a human body. So that this is a materialistic religion, and we must be proud of it. Now, dualism opposed this, and there were tremendous battles that went on in the early church. Because dualism said, no, the material world is evil, and the body is evil, and you must somehow or other extricate yourself from the entanglements of the material in order to be spiritual. This dualism came from two sources, and it saturated the world at the time when Christianity was growing and developing. The first source was from the Orient. The Oriental religions are what we call world-denying religions, whereas Christianity and Judaism are world-affirming religions. And in order that you may understand the attitude of the Oriental religions, at least part of the attitude of the Oriental religions, I want to read you something from Buddhist writing, which is right in this field and which dramatizes my point. If you are plagued with desire for bodily pleasures, go out to the field where the corpses are burned. As you look at the half-burned bodies and the disjointed bones, you can contemplate the body as it really is. This beautiful girl who stirs me so, what is she really but a bag of skin filled with a pulp of blood, tissue, and repulsive internal organs hung on a grisly skeleton? This is just another body taking its short and ignoble journey between birth and death, one insignificant swirl of matter in a world full of pain and illusion. Let it go. This is Buddhism. Hinduism doesn't entirely take that position, but I remember in reading the autobiography of that great man Gandhi, whom I had the privilege to meet and whom I greatly admire in other respects, and I read in his autobiography how Gandhi at a certain point in his life reached an agreement with his wife that they would discontinue their sex relations in marriage in order that they might live more spiritual lives. This is dualism living on today in a great Oriental. The other source of dualism was Neoplatonism, the philosophy that burgeoned under the Hellenistic culture after the decay of the classical Greek period. Plato was not very much sold on sex. We still have today the term a platonic friendship between a man and a woman, which means a relationship with no sexual component. There is, of course, no such thing, but Plato emphasized this, and because of Plato's view, a philosophy of dualism spread very widely throughout the world of that time, in which sex, because it was of the body, was considered to be evil, and in order to become spiritual, you had to deny your body, including your sexual feelings and responses. Now, this was the negative atmosphere that began to pervade the world of the early church, and it infiltrated into the Bible teaching and did great harm. Let me give you some examples. First, it got into the fall story, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and there were some writers who said that the fall of man in the Garden of Eden had a largely sexual significance. The serpent was a sexual symbol, and they played on that. Those who didn't take that extreme view did feel that somehow or other the sexuality of Adam and Eve was very deeply corrupted and tainted by the fall, and we'll come back to that in a moment. I won't linger on it now. Then secondly, there were many of dualistic philosophy who noted that the three great figures in the New Testament, John the Baptist, Jesus himself, and Paul, were all unmarried, were all celibate. And they seized on this and said that this was surely a proof that the unmarried life, the sexless life, was the one most pleasing to God. Then thirdly, the virgin birth was focused on and produced as a proof that the sex relationship is an unholy thing. And very soon it was widely believed and propagated by the church that Mary, the mother of Jesus, never did have sex relations with her husband, that she lived in perpetual virginity, and they pictured Joseph as a benevolent elderly man who took a kind of fatherly or older brotherly protective interest in her, but there was no sex life in their marriage. The virgin birth led, of course, in due course, not until 1854, to the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, because by that time the microscope had discovered the existence of the sperm and ovum, and it was realized that according to the virgin birth, it might be that something of Mary's own identity and ancestry had contributed to the conception of Jesus, and that this was intolerable to the church. So they had to create the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception to separate Mary off from the rest of mankind, and this led them, of course, only a few years ago to the final stage of the doctrine of the Assumption of the Virgin, in which they turned the mother of Jesus virtually into a goddess. All this arose from misconceptions of the virgin birth. And then fourthly, the sexual excesses that were widespread in the pagan world of the New Testament period led to a feeling that sex really gave people so much trouble that it was better, on the whole, if you wanted to be spiritual, to leave it alone. When Paul was writing to the struggling young converts in the church of Corinth, he knew that they were living in the most licentious city of the world of that time. In the temple of Venus in Corinth, there were said to be 1,000 temple prostitutes, and this was a city with a great deal of iniquity going on. And this awareness of the licentiousness of the decaying Roman Empire confronted the Christians with so much misuse of sex that they were easily persuaded that sex was so easily misused that it was best to reject it altogether. And some of them went to great extremes in trying to renounce sex. Origen, the great father and wise teacher of the early church, who lived from 182 to 251, actually, in a frenzy of religious zeal, cut off his sex organs, castrated himself, because he thought that by doing so he could be a better Christian. Now, these things opened up the way to a whole era of tragic departure from Bible truth about sex. And I want very quickly to run through some of the stages of the Christian tradition. Of course, in just a few minutes, I cannot do justice to such an immense subject. I will simply have to pick out a few highlights, but I hope I may give you a generally accurate picture of what happened. And I begin with the early church. When we talk about the early church, we generally mean the first 500 years of Christianity. And in this period, it is natural to single out Augustine, who lived from 354 to 430, and who stood head and shoulders above the other fathers of the early church. I call him Augustine because that's the British pronunciation, and I'm British. I believe that some of you say Augustine here, and you'll forgive me if I stick to my own pronunciation. Augustine was a man of very involved psychology, a brilliant analysis of his own personal psychology has been given by Sherwin Bailey in one of the books that I'm recommending to you, Christian Religion in Sexual Thought. Augustine had a lot of trouble with sex in his youth. He consorted with one or two or more concubines, and he came under the influence of the Manichaean heresy, which was one of these dualistic heresies that said sex was very bad. And Augustine had desperate struggles with his sex desires, but he never managed to control them. And he went from bad to worse until he was in a state of despair. And then he heard a Christian bishop preaching, I think in Milan, and he underwent a conversion to Christianity. Now, Augustine was a great convert to Christianity. He was a tremendous scholar and a great man, but he had a sadly twisted personality in the area of sex. And Sherwin Bailey says, rightly, I think, that what conversion to Christianity meant to Augustine was, at last, I'm through with sex. So that we find in his teaching, which was very considerable, that his preoccupation with the evils of sex is very central. His confessions, which are very honest confessions, and one, the Confessions of St. Augustine is one of the Christian classics, brings out some of his own personal problems. Now, in trying to understand Christian doctrine, Augustine came to the conclusion that original sin in the Garden of Eden had very deeply corrupted the sexual faculty of Adam and Eve, and that the results of their fall into sin had been heavily focused in their sex life, so that sex desire was itself sinful. He introduced the concept of what he called concupiscence, and this concept of concupiscence went all the way down through the history of the church. Concupiscence, broadly speaking, was wider than sexual desire, but for all practical purposes it meant sexual desire. And Augustine's teaching was that sexual desire is in itself sinful or tending towards sin. He developed also another doctrine that it is through sexual desire that sin is transmitted from generation to generation. It is because when we beget children, we have sexual desire, that our original sin is transmitted to our children, so that our children are conceived in sin because they are conceived as a result of sexual desire. This was the doctrine of St. Augustine. So as a result of all this, he proclaimed that to be a real Christian, you should renounce sex entirely and live a celibate life. But he said, maybe you can't all do that. And if you simply can't control your sexual desires, and you'd be likely to get into bad trouble and fall into serious sins otherwise, okay, you'd better marry, because that way you won't sin quite so badly. But he made it quite clear that all sex tinged by concupiscence or desire was sinful unless it was undertaken deliberately and exclusively for procreation. Then it was all right. Then it was acceptable. But otherwise it was sinful. And he argued that the patriarchs in the Old Testament, who of course married and had many children, were very virtuous and upright men who, although they had sexual intercourse with their wives, did so only in order to beget children, and did so in some miraculous way without the concomitant of sexual desire. I've often wondered what the patriarchs would have thought of Augustine's explanation of their sex lives. And so what Augustine really said was that unless you can have intercourse without desire, which is psychologically impossible, and with the entirely calm, collected, and dispassionate objective of begetting a child, unless you can do that, anything sexual you do in marriage is sinful. But if you have sexual intercourse in marriage, because if you didn't, you might go out and rape somebody, that is to say, it would save you from worse sin, it was still sinful, but it was venial sin, that is to say, it could be pardoned. Now, this may sound pretty horrible to you, but this teaching of Augustine was widely accepted throughout the early church and became the accepted Christian teaching. For instance, Ambrose, the benign early father who said some very nice things in other connections, said once, married people ought to blush when they consider the sort of life they live. They ought to blush when they consider the sort of life they live, meaning their sex life, of course. Geoffrey May, in his book The Social Control of Sexual Expression, sums up this early church development by saying, within four centuries, Christianity had exchanged emotional expression for emotional suppression. The gospel virtues had been charity and love. The patristic virtues were abstinence and asceticism. Now I move to the medieval church. And here the great figure is Thomas Aquinas, who gathered together a group of scholars. He lived in 1225 to 1274, and among them they systematized the Christian doctrine. And they did it within the context of Greek philosophy, and particularly the philosophical concepts of Aristotle. Now this, you may notice, was about 900 years after Augustine, and Aquinas almost entirely accepted and agreed with Augustine's teaching, which had been the accepted teaching within the Christian church during the 900 years intervening. But Aquinas developed it a little further, and the concept that he developed was that the Christian life could be lived at two levels. There were two levels of Christian living. The higher level was those who completely renounced sex and lived celibate lives, the sexless Christians. They were the really spiritual ones, and they were at the high level. And then down below, there was another bunch of Christians, a much bigger one, at the lower level, and they were the people who married. They were the everyday commonplace Christians who had not had the moral strength to cut sex completely out of their lives. They were Christians, they were part of the church, but they could never attain the levels of spirituality of the celibates. He saw sex desire, and especially the orgasm, as an experience, an emotional experience that overwhelmed the reason. And for Aquinas, reared in the Greek tradition of contemplative scholarship, reason was everything. And since you couldn't be controlled by reason when you were under the power of sexual desire, this made sexual desire inherently evil. Aquinas went on to catalog the sexual sins in the order of their sinfulness, and I will come back to that catalog in a later lecture. We'll leave it aside just for the time being. Now I move to the Counter-Reformation and the Council of Trent, which was from 1545 to 1563, when for a period of 18 years the Catholic Church made its doctrines authoritative in opposition to the Reformation. At the Council of Trent, an interesting thing that happened was that marriage was confirmed as a sacrament. Now, in view of all the discouraging things that had been said in the early and medieval church about marriage, it's rather extraordinary that it was made a sacrament. The beginning of this was in the time of Peter the Lombard, about 1100 to 1164. There are some people who think that the making of marriage into a sacrament was due to a misunderstanding of the Latin word sacramentum, which was used in Latin translations of the Bible, and which does not mean sacrament, but mystery. I don't know whether that's true, but it's pretty clear to me that the psychological reason why marriage was made a sacrament by the Catholic Church was that they had downgraded it so badly in their overestimate of the importance of celibacy that they felt guilty about the fact that marriage had obviously been ordained by God in the Old Testament and blessed by Christ in the New Testament. And they wanted to restore it to some kind of status, so they made it a sacrament. It's interesting that Graham Cole indicates rather dryly that the church with the unmarried clergy made marriage a sacrament, while the church with the married clergy denied that it was a sacrament. But you must note that the Council of Trent, while it made marriage a sacrament to salve their consciences, made it very clear that the state of celibacy was spiritually higher than the state of marriage. That is to say, they wrote into official Catholic doctrine the two levels of the Christian life, And there is one of the enactments of the Council of Trent which says that anybody who says that the state of celibacy is not spiritually superior to the state of marriage shall be anathema. The Council of Trent did soften a little bit, or try to soften, the teaching of Augustine and Augustine and Aquinas. Speaking of concupiscence, the Council of Trent said, concupiscence is not sin itself, but it is an incentive to sin. I'm not quite sure what that means, but they go on to elaborate a little by saying that if in marriage you do have sexual intercourse with your wife, and you do it on a basis of desire, as you must, of course, it's not so bad if you resist manfully. If you resist manfully. Now, I suppose that means you must go down fighting. I don't know. But you see the twisted up philosophy that these celibate men were foisting on the married couples. The Council of Trent betrayed its real attitude by saying that married couples must not have intercourse on their wedding night out of respect for the spirituality of the service, and that they must never go to communion unless they had not had intercourse for 3 days previously, because they were polluted and unfit for the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And during Lent, they must very frequently abstain from sexual intercourse in order that they might be in the right spiritual frame of mind to observe Lent. As Sherwin Bailey says, sex pleasure was simply not compatible with the spiritual life. Now, there the Catholic doctrine of sex rests. There have been desperate attempts in recent times, and particularly in our own time, to soften this harsh doctrine. A Catholic writer of the name of E.C. Messenger wrote a book recently called Two in One Flesh, in which he tries very, very hard to say some more reasonable things. But Graham Cole is right, I think, when he says, and I quote him, "This whole outlook was utterly foreign to the Bible." Now let me give you some practical implications of these doctrines, because of course, as doctrines, they were just statements. But what did they do to people in the life of the church? First, let me say something about the attitude to woman. Freud had the insight to see that the world of Western Christendom has been in a state of dilemma about woman. Freud said that it could not see woman in focus, that Western Christendom could only see woman at two extremes. They saw her as the sexless woman, the virgin, as the Madonna and the Queen of Heaven. And at the other end of the continuum, they saw her as the sexual woman, the prostitute, and the gate of hell. But they couldn't bring her into focus between these two extremes. And this is a pretty shrewd observation, because the attitudes of the early and medieval church to women were so far removed from the attitude of Jesus that it's almost unbelievable. Let me read you something from Tertullian. Tertullian is speaking to Christian women. He says, "Do you not know that you are each an Eve? The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives on in this age. The guilt must of necessity live too. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack," presumably Adam. "You destroyed so easily God's image, man. On account of your desert, that is death, even the Son of God had to die." This was Tertullian's address to Christian women. In three of the monastic codes, the penalty for speaking alone with a woman was 100 to 200 stripes. The desert hermits fled at the sight of a woman as they fled from the devil, and they were enjoined so to do. Women were forbidden to enter monastery churches, even to pray or to worship. In 1193, the abbot of Salem was severely punished, and his offense, he had allowed a gracious Christian lady to be buried in the church, and he was told that this was to desecrate the sanctuary. Geoffrey May sums up this twisted attitude by saying, in trying to desexualize men, ascetic Christianity only over-sexualized woman. Then I want to say something about sacerdotal celibacy. The view of the early church was that marriage was degrading, and therefore it was unsuitable for priests who fulfilled the holy functions. And if you want to read the history of sacerdotal celibacy in vivid terms, read Henry C. Lee's two-volume work. It's a shocker. In the year 305, and this was fairly early on, one of the great councils, the Council of Elvara in Spain, issued this proclamation: all concerned with the ministry of the altar must henceforth practice abstinence from their wives or forfeit their position. By the end of that century, the fourth century, sacerdotal celibacy had become law, and no priest was allowed to marry. This proved to be a very hard enactment to enforce, and as we read the history of the church, we see plenty of evidence that the clergy were not very successful in avoiding sexual relationships. Many of the popes had swarms of illegitimate children, and a number of them suffered from venereal disease. In Luther's time, there were multitudes of priests who were living with concubines and their children, and Luther, in his great compassion, urged them to marry in order, to quote his words, in order that you might be relieved of this great burden of guilt. Now, out of sacerdotal celibacy, there came monasticism, which was a breakaway from the Hebrew family ideal. The family, as we saw this morning, was completely central to the Hebrew religious community. But monasticism substituted for the family as the religious community a segregated one-sex community. And people were encouraged to go into convents and monasteries, even if when they were married with families. The story of Anthony of Egypt was not atypical. Anthony of Egypt, who forsook his wife and weeping children, left them to the mercies of a cruel and hard world in order that he might devote himself to God by going into a monastery. Now, monasticism throughout Christian history has done a great deal of good. There's no question about that. And if you want to understand the story of monasticism, read H.B. Workman's great and scholarly work on the subject. He was one of my teachers in my early days in England. Monasticism preserved learning and craftsmanship throughout the Dark Ages, and we owe it a great debt. It produced some great saints, but it did this at a terrible price. For in the monasteries and in the convents, there was an endless human struggle going on while men and women tried to suppress their sexual needs and sexual desires. They used all kinds of desperate devices. Flagellation was very common, lashing of one another so as to drive away sexual desire. One offered the recommendation that starvation was a splendid remedy, that chastity is much more easy to maintain on an empty stomach. The penitentials, which were spelled out in tiresome detail, list the endless varieties of sexual sins into which you could fall, and all the detailed penalties and punishments which were appropriate to them all. Even when they managed to suppress their sexual needs, for many of these holy men and women, there was an eruption of sexual interest in the erotic ideas and erotic fantasies which they linked with religion as compensatory mechanisms. You read the visions of St. Gertrude, for example, they're full of tender, affectionate terms about how now she is married to Christ and how Christ is her lover, and all kinds of erotic, affectionate language is used to express her struggles with her sexual needs. St. Teresa also uses the same terms, and many of the others. But I want to give you a rather more recent and interesting illustration. There was a girl called Antoinette Bourignon who lived in the city of Lyon in France from 1616 to 1680. Antoinette Bourignon was the daughter of a wealthy silk merchant of Lyon, brought up in a beautiful home, well-educated, a cultured girl. And in the course of time, she became engaged to a fine young man in her community, and she and her family and all her friends were looking forward to the great occasion of her marriage. But Antoinette got talking to some nuns, and they put some ideas into her head. And she went through a period of great emotional and spiritual agony, which came to a head on the evening before her wedding had been arranged. And late that night, in her room, in an agony of uncertainty, she reached her decision. She cut off her lovely tresses of hair, she took off her jewels and her beautiful clothes and dressed herself in rags. And then before she left, she sat down at the desk in her room and wrote out a little poem which she left for her parents. That poem was translated from the French by no less a person than John Wesley, and here are four stanzas from it. Come, Savior Jesus from above, assist me with thy heavenly grace, empty my heart of earthly love, and for thyself prepare the place. Henceforth may no profane delight divide this consecrated soul. Possess it thou who hast the right as Lord and Master of the whole. Thee I can love, and thee alone, with pure delight and inward bliss. To know thou takest me for thine own, oh, what a happiness is this! Nothing on earth do I desire but thy pure love within my breast. This, only this, will I require, and freely give up all the rest. Now that's a beautiful expression of dedication to Christ, which any young person might be proud to take upon his lips. But the tragedy for Antoinette Bourignon was that she thought she could only dedicate herself to Christ by breaking with the fine young man who was expecting to marry her and breaking with all her hopes of marriage and motherhood. The tragedy for Antoinette Bourignon was that she did not understand that she could love Christ and love her husband too, and that the divine love and the human life could supplement each other. She was a victim of the tragedy of the church that had moved so far away from the Bible. Now I want to say a few words in conclusion about Protestant thought in this area. Luther, who lived from 1483 to 1546, broke with the Catholic tradition. And one of the things he did was to reject outright the two-level concept of the Christian life. He completely rejected the idea that there were two levels of Christian living. He declared that the celibate might seek spiritual heights through his renunciation of marriage, but that married people equally could reach spiritual heights in the discipline of their life together. He said that marriage was a fitting relationship for the exercise of all the Christian virtues. And to prove his point, he himself married. At the age of 42, he married Catherine von Bora, who was 27 and who herself had been a nun for 14 years. So you see that she began the celibate life at an age at which she was hardly capable of making a responsible decision. They married and they had a good life together. Luther, however, did not break from the tradition in which he had been raised, because he recognized that celibacy was a good life for the select few, and his writings rather suggest that he still took the view that celibacy was really the best way. But what he said in his forthright way was that most of us just can't make it. We haven't got that kind of resolution or that kind of makeup. For most of us, the sex urge is too strong and cannot and will not be suppressed. And he did not only say that if you can't live without sex, you may marry. He went further. He said you should marry. He said it is your duty to marry if you can't otherwise control your sexual feelings and desires. And these are his words. He says, your body demands and needs it. God wills it and insists on it. But Luther said that marriage was not a sacrament. He said it is a universal human tradition, and this is true. He said the heathen practice it as well as the Christians. It is therefore, in essence, a secular matter and belongs to the civil powers. Of course, he said there are particular qualities that Christian people bring to their marriage, but there is not a Christian marriage as such, distinct from any other kind of marriage. Marriage for Christians carries the Christian blessing, but it is essentially not a sacrament. But when we really examine Luther's thought about sex, we do find, to our disappointment, that there's really no change, that it's business as usual, because Luther really agreed with Augustine and with Aquinas that the fall of man had in a particular way corrupted the sex drive, and he said that human sexuality, because of man's fall, has about it a brute-like quality. Those are his words, a brute-like quality. And therefore, it must be inherently sinful. He said, as Augustine had said and as Aquinas had said, that concupiscence was essentially sinful. It is quite clear that he agreed with them that even sex relations in marriage were inherently sinful. But he said, God is merciful and understanding, and although you are sinning, God winks at your sin. This was just his way of saying what the Catholics had said when they said that venial sin was the nature of the offense of those who used sex in marriage because they couldn't suppress it. Although Luther had a good marriage with Catherine von Bora, it was not what we would call a love match. It was a kind of rough and ready kind of arrangement in which they supplemented each other and brought up their children. But Luther never glimpsed what we feel is the Christian view of the sex life in marriage, because he said, and this was one of his utterances, it is impossible to pray upon the marriage bed. It is impossible to pray upon the marriage bed. And so for Luther, marriage was still essentially a remedy for sin, a way of controlling concupiscence in a way that did not allow the raging, rampaging force of sex to get seriously out of control. And even in his attitudes to divorce, in which he allowed divorce under certain circumstances, the thread that runs through them all is that he's sorry for divorced people who are deprived of a normal sex life. And you might almost say that just as Paul said it is better to marry than to burn, Luther said of the divorced it is better to remarry than to burn. Calvin, in conclusion, who lived about the same time as Luther, agreed substantially with Luther that celibacy was the best way for Christians, but there were very few who could manage it, and the rest must marry out of necessity. Calvin attempted, as Aquinas had done, to make a catalogue of the sexual sins in their order of seriousness, dividing them into natural and unnatural sins, and I will come back to that later. Both of the reformers, Luther and Calvin, were married men, and this did something for them, because it is clear from their writings that they take a more realistic view of sex than the celibates, and they're more human and understanding about people in their sex life. But I'm afraid that under the Reformation there was no positive doctrine yet emerging of sex. They were too close to the ascetic past to break away from the chains that had bound the church for so long. And although Protestantism has moved some distance since, as we shall see, this traditional attitude has still lingered on. It reappeared in Puritanism, and there's a lovely verse about the Puritan that I'll quote you. The Puritan through life's fair garden goes and plucks the thorn and casts away the rose. He hopes to please by this peculiar whim the God who made and fashioned it for him. Puritanism resuscitated the dualism that had been so hostile to Christian Bible teaching. And even in our own time, I remember in London some years ago going to a meeting of the Oxford Group, which was a kind of pseudo-Christian movement, and hearing a man testify to the change that had come in his life since he'd belonged to the Oxford Group. And then I heard him say this. He said, "With God's help, my wife and I have been able to cut sex out of our lives. We were sex mates, we are now spiritual mates." Here again was the old dualism raising its head once more, even in this enlightened time. The church is having at last to meet the challenge against this distortion of Bible teaching. And the challenge is coming not from within the church, but from outside, in the form of what we call the sexual revolution. And the subject of my lecture tomorrow morning is to try to explain to you what that sexual revolution is and how it is challenging Christians today. Now I think our time is up, and we'll dismiss at once.